because you want to know what you're getting for your $47 zoo membership. You will see Pete, the lowland gorilla, Xerxes, the lion, Denali, the grizzly, no bamboo, no chai. Good morning. This is KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, and I have a cold. Is Woodland Park Zoo doing the right thing by shipping its elephants to another zoo? We're going to discuss that in just a few minutes. You can wait for that, or you can tell us right now on our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. We are live tweeting the show, as always, and we're on the phone, 206-685-2526. 685, a blam. Good morning. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Joni Balter, Civic Cocktail, Seattle Channel, Bloomberg View. Welcome back, Joni.
Good morning.
We're so pleased to have Sherman Alexie, who's written some books you may have heard of, and there's been movies and other properties.
And stuff. Yep. Good morning.
Thanks for coming, bestseller. Knut Berger, mossbackercrosscut.com, who's written a bunch of books himself. Space Needle.
And stuff.
Yeah. And stuff. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, Bill.
So, top stories, and there are a lot of them. It's been a very interesting week. This week, Seattle's Woodland Park Zoo said it will close its elephant exhibit. KUOW's Deborah Wong gives us the zoo's reasons for saying goodbye to chai and bamboo.
Elephants are social animals. They live in herds in the wild, and the prevailing wisdom is that they should be in a herd of at least three or more animals in a zoo. Now, the zoo had three animals, but earlier this year, it lost one of them. Watoto, the African elephant, had to be euthanized.
And the zoo has not been able to find more elephants. It is illegal to import them into the United States. They have not been breeding well in zoos, so rather than keep chai and bamboo lonely, the zoo will send them to another zoo. Joni, this is not making animal rights activists happy. Why not?
Okay, so Bill, years from now when you retire and you're in retirement, do you still want to get up at 3 a.m. every morning and come in and write witty commentary? Or would you like to go to a warm, sunny climate where, for the purposes of this discussion, you're on elephant time? That's what they're saying. They're saying that would be the better choice, that chai and bamboo have earned the right to a sunny climate.
Can I fling dung?
Possibly. I think we should discuss that.
I'm in.
Elephant time.
I'm a buyer.
Elephant things. Otherwise, if they still go to another zoo, they're still working for the man.
Right. People want animal rights activists, and apparently our listeners really want these elephants to be in a wildlife sanctuary. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, am I right? On Facebook, it seemed almost unanimous.
Yes. In a word, our Facebook audience wants sanctuary for these animals. A zoo isn't good enough as far as they're concerned.
Right.
Now, just so you know, there is some debate about, you know, sanctuary sounds like just one step shy of heaven, right? Mm. So there is some debate about what kind of treatment the animals get in the sanctuary. The zoo folks think that zoos provide better treatment and care, but that's up for the big debate here.
Right. Well, a zoo is not going to announce, we are sending our animals to a sanctuary where life is not horrible like it is in zoos, right? I mean, that would be pretty weird for them to, for that
it's
to be their stance.
Move for them.
Zoos like zoos.
Well, I think the silliest part of this is the names. Chai and bamboo, which sounds like half the students in a Seattle elementary school as well. but really, you know, I actually researched this, and the sanctuaries are pretty iffy, too.
They got
a serious carny feel about them.
Uh-huh. Yeah, some of them can be that way. There's mixed report card on sanctuaries.
So I think they're just as profit-driven, or in fact more profit-driven when you think about a zoo as being at least a public trust, that these sanctuaries are private and often pretty sketchy. So it's a distinction without a difference. Mm. It feels like somebody's telling me they're going to send the elephants from Walla Walla State Pen to Lompoc in California, and things are going to go better for them.
And there's a history to this, right, Canoe? There was the Seattle Times investigation. And some city council members have been leaning on the zoo, right?
Oh, that's right. And part of the pressure has come from because of public funding of the zoo and the fact that it's at least a semi-public entity. There's a lot of goodwill toward the zoo, and that we want to think that we treat animals humanely. People in Seattle have, you know, the elephants have been part of the zoo for a long time, and they used to really play it up. I remember when I was a kid that you got this blue elephant key card with the where the nose, the trunk of the elephant went into a little box, and you turned it at each exhibit, and a voice would then tell you about the animals.
Mm-hmm.
And you used to actually be able to go on elephant rides at the zoo. I went on an elephant ride at the zoo.
Seriously? You sat on an elephant?
Sure, yeah. Well, you sit in a little box. It's like a saddle, you know, that's strapped to the thing. And, you know, elephants are, in some cases, especially Asian elephants, are semi-domesticated in the sense that they've been used for physical labor, like oxen. You go to India now and drive down the highway and suddenly a big elephant will come out hauling a bunch of logs. Or
you've been to India.
Whatever. I have been to India, and I have seen, I almost ran into an elephant. But I think public values change toward the treatment of animals, and the history of the treatment of elephants in circuses and zoos has been really horrendous. And I think part of what is being said here is that even under the sort of best of conditions at the Woodland Park Zoo, it's inadequate for these animals. And, you know, that's a debate going on over orcas. It's going on over other things. And I, you know, I can see the both sides in the sense that I think it's great for people to actually be up close to animals like that. It gives you an appreciation you can't get off television or a nature special. On the other hand, the social problems and the kind of confinement and restraints and whatnot seem to be really problematic.
Bond, didn't at least one commenter bring up the climate issue around here?
Yes. Nicole adds, yay, those elephants are depressing. They look miserable and probably hate this weather.
Don't you wonder about that when you go to Woodland Park Zoo? Like, why can't we have climate-appropriate zoos so that in Seattle, if you want to see elks and otters, you go to the Woodland Park Zoo. But if you want to see penguins, go to the Barrow, Alaska Zoo. If you, you know, you will love the lion exhibit at the zoo in Death Valley. But why are these animals shivering?
But you're touching on sort of one of the fears here is that slippery slope and elephant, maybe not such a good pairing in a sentence, but the idea here is that perhaps folks will want to go after the other exhibits at the zoo and say something else is wrong, not the right climate, too small, too big, next to the wrong animals.
Giraffes. Why should there be a giraffe exhibit?
And there's always this measure, too. It's this sort of cuteness and high IQ measurement of which animals deserve better treatment than others.
Yep.
Orcas, whales, dolphins, and certainly they are higher on the IQ scale. But, you know, are they going to be as concerned about the life of a badger? I don't really recall any big protests about badgers in zoos. So they're still making moral distinctions among animals,
yes,
and deciding which are more valuable than others.
Right.
Yeah, and I don't think I've ever been to the zoo where I haven't felt tugged looking at an animal that clearly seems unhappy.
Right.
You know, you'll see a cat going back and forth and back and forth, you know, as if they're crazy.
Yeah.
I think.
And they have these giant enclosures, except go sometime when it's cold. Where are the animals hanging out? They're hanging out where the heat lamps are, which are by the windows.
And I hate those videos that show up on YouTube of like a tiger gnawing at the window when the toddler is standing there and everybody's laughing.
Right.
And I start rooting for the tiger, like break through the glass, break through the glass.
Right. Little kid, you have this tiger's fate in your hands. This tiger's begging you.
Yes.
No one else is listening, Curtis. Okay, well, what's going to happen next? We're going to hear from the Woodland Park Zoo eventually about where these animals are going.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, their board is trying to reconcile what happens next. They did, you recall here, they did try to find other elephants to bring in. There was either expand or there was send these guys packing.
Right.
Were the choices. So now it's which place to go.
Do we need zoos when we have we can put webcams in forests and jungles?
Well, that's the whole argument about calling these ambassadors. I mean, it's...
You look annoyed.
It's what Skip said earlier. Go ahead, annoyed.
Well, I've always been uncomfortable with zoos, but I also, as I was saying earlier, I recognize their value. I mean, I take my granddaughter to the zoo. I took my kids to the zoo.
Yep, I've taken my kids.
You know, they've learned a lot about animals. They've appreciated a lot. And you can't get that in a video. You can't get the smell. You don't get the sounds. You don't get a lot of the social interaction between the animals.
You mean the begging? begging for sweet, sweet death.
Yeah, you know, it really. I mean, it really varies on the species, and I'd hate to say, I wouldn't want to ban all zoos.
Did you do the realistic visits to the zoo? We're members, but even when my kids were little, I'd be telling them the truth. You know, that if the glass wasn't there, that wolf would eat you.
Yes.
That lion would eat you.
Always that, makes that a hot ticket item.
Yeah, that gorilla is 78 times stronger than your dad.
Right.
So
those children you see crying at Woodland Park Zoo, those are Sherman Alexie's kids. And we'll be right back on KUOW's Week in Review. Sherman Alexie, Knute Berger, and Joni Balter, and I'm Bill Radke, reviewing the news of the week, as we do. Last night, President Obama unveiled executive actions on immigration. His new rules will spare nearly 5 million people from deportation, at least temporarily. Obama said he's not making law, he's just refocusing enforcement efforts on criminals rather than children and families.
If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation. You can come out of the shadows and get right with the law.
There are a lot of people in Seattle who are happy about this. Yesterday, in anticipation of the president's speech, immigration advocates rallied in downtown Seattle. KUOW's Liz Jones was in the crowd.
One young woman kind of struck me. She came from the Dominican Republic, and her father here had legal citizenship, but her mother had to go back to the Dominican Republic. And her father ended up raising her and her six siblings here alone. So a lot of stories like that you're hearing from people of families torn apart where they want to see Obama change who is put into deportation proceedings and who immigration officials go after for deportation.
Okay, so some happy immigration advocates downtown. Who else is happy? Well, Seattle's tech companies can be somewhat happy because they want to hire tech-skilled immigrants, and the president said this.
I'll make it easier and faster for high-skilled immigrants, graduates, and entrepreneurs to stay and contribute to our economy, as so many business leaders have proposed.
And there are a lot of Seattle liberals who are happy because our immigration system is heartless. The Republicans are obnoxious. Obama has been a doormat. He's finally coming to life. And Republicans threatening to shut down the government or impeach Obama, that's just delivering votes to Hillary in 2016. This is great. But should even liberals worry about the precedent here of a president ignoring the will of Congress? Let's get some facts about this first. On the line with us is Andrea Seabrook, who covered Congress for NPR, and now she hosts a podcast called Decode DC. Andrea, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, in 2011, President Obama said that he sometimes wishes he could bypass Congress on immigration reform, but, quote, that's not how our system works. That's not how our democracy functions. That's not how our Constitution is written. Is President Obama flip-flopping and essentially rewriting the Constitution?
Well, I would say that he is. There's a little bit of a flip-flop there, but rewriting the Constitution, no, he is not doing that. There have been many presidents who have used the executive order much, much more than Barack Obama has. Even George W. Bush used it a little bit more over his two terms than Barack Obama has. It peaked with FDR. FDR carried out more than 290 executive actions that reordered the government. One thing that people don't tend to know about Washington is that the vast federal bureaucracy is really run by what are known in town as regs, regulations. And those regulations are sort of the interpretation by the executive branch of the laws that the Congress passes. And when Congress is in total gridlock, as it has been for several years now, the balance of power in Washington flows toward the White House because the executive can reorder those regulations and make things happen in a different way.
Well, Reagan and Bush did issue executive orders on immigration, but Reagan was doing a modification to an immigration law that Congress passed and he signed. This is a case where the president is going against Congress's intent, saying that Congress refused to act. Aren't those two different things?
I don't think anyone can say what Congress's intent is right now. There's a lot of very loud people
who have said a lot of things. There was a bill in the Senate that was bipartisan but never came up in the House. And so I don't think, you know, saying that he is going against the intent of Congress is, you know, that's not actually true. If Congress had the intent of not doing what he, what President Obama is trying to do with regulations, they could make that not happen. They pass the laws. But unfortunately, they don't have the kind of majority in either chamber, and not even with the Republicans coming in as in control of the Senate. They don't have the unanimity to even figure out what to do. I mean, the reaction today from Republican leaders in both the House and the Senate and all kinds of other Republicans has been all over the map. John Boehner, the House Speaker, basically said, "We're going to do something. Don't you? We're going to do something." But he can't say what because his own party is so divided over this.
How can Republicans undo his executive order? What else can they do?
Well, there are a lot of options being tossed around. One of them is to pass a bill that says the president can't use any money to fund the reorganization of these regulations. The problem with that, of course, is that most immigration policies are actually funded by fees that are charged to immigrants coming in. They don't actually get that much money from the U.S. Treasury, and so Congress would have to pass a special kind of rider saying you can't use any of the fees it collects. And you know, there's not even unanimity on that, much less any of the other plans. And, you know, it's no mistake that this came right now after the election and before the new Congress came in. President Obama is driving a wedge straight down the middle of the Republican Party and forcing them into a position they don't want to be in. There are 100 ideas for how to stop the president from doing that, ranging from impeachment to working with him. And they don't have any unified idea right now.
Final question for Andrea Seabrook. Bottom line, are you saying that the President Obama last night set no new precedent when it comes to overriding Congress?
I'm saying that there is no Congress to override. Congress has done nothing.
So these fears that he's gone further than other presidents, you're saying... Not true. There's no precedent being set for future presidents overriding the quote unquote will of Congress.
I'm sure that is one of the arguments out there. But presidents ranging from Theodore Roosevelt, Taft, Wilson, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, Roosevelt used the executive action far more than President Obama has, and far more than this one executive order means.
Okay. Andrea Seabrook, who covered Congress for NPR, hosts a podcast now called Decode DC. Andrea, thanks a lot for filling us in.
Well, thank you.
Back to our panel on KOW's Week in Review. What did you learn?
Well, a couple of things I've learned. One is that I'm still waiting for the thank you note from Hillary Clinton to Barack Obama, because what he has done here, if you think about the long game, there will be quite a lot of sturm und drang over this whole thing right now. But long game, what he has done is he has drawn a very bright line of distinction between what Democrats largely, except for the folks in the Senate who voted, the Republicans in the Senate who voted for immigration reform, but largely between Democrats and Republicans for who is willing to take on these issues about immigration. And that's a big deal for 2016 in many elections, including the presidential one. So Hillary,
yeah. So if it's a political winner for Hillary, does that mean you don't care whether Obama is or is not being tyrannical?
I think he's being cynical. I think it's a completely cynical move. I think he realizes it's fairly powerless and symbolic what he's doing, and it's really just a campaign strategy.
It's temporary. I mean, other presidents or Congress could come in and change the rules that he just made.
The next president will change it, depending on if nothing in Congress happens. And the thing about Congress, though, is, you know, we keep talking about how unpopular Obama is, but Congress is 3 or 4 times more unpopular. So
in a group, yes, but everybody gets virtually all the members of Congress get reelected locally.
That has nothing to do with their popularity nationally.
Right.
So everything that Obama does from now on is geared toward Hillary in 2016. Everything he's going to be doing is geared toward that.
Well, I see it. I don't see it that way. I mean, that is a component of it for sure, as a way to put the Democrat party on the right side of demographics. It's incremental. That's very Obama. He's doing it within the law. I don't think this executive action is outside the law by any means. And in fact, as your guest was saying, the last president who used the executive orders less than Obama was the first term of Grover Cleveland. Mm-hmm. In other words, this is business as usual in every respect. And I think the larger thing is that it, while it's not a final solution, it doesn't put people on a pathway to citizenship, it's an effort to get people legalized in the sense of getting them out of the shadows. And I think the forces against immigration reform are forces that are very strong in the Republican Party. One is xenophobia and racism, and the other is people who benefit by having low-wage workers who have no recourse, who the threat of deportation, you know, puts them in a situation where they can be exploited.
Well, there is a big concern about rewarding lawbreakers, to be fair to Republican immigration reform opponents.
Yes, there are other factors in there, but those are two kind of large constituencies. Mm-hmm. People who actually like the status quo. There is no way, and I think Obama's being very realistic about this, that you could turn around and throw 12 million people
right
out of the country
right
and deport them. So I actually think it's a good move. I think it's a very Obama move, and it'll be really interesting to see how the chessboard plays out.
In a moment, I want to talk about Sherman Alexie and books and money and South Lake Union and stuff when we come back on the Week in Review. Do not go away. KUOW's Week in Review continues with Joni Balter and Knute Berger and best-selling author Sherman Alexie, whose publisher is the Hachette Group. Yes,
one of my publishers.
One of his many publishers, which settled its dispute with Amazon. Amazon, as you probably know, wants publishers like Hachette to lower their book prices. Writers like Sherman were caught in the crossfire because Amazon was blocking pre-orders on Hachette titles on its site, and that hurt sales. The last time Sherman Alexie was on our program, we were in front of a live audience, and I asked him, what has Amazon ever done to you?
Well, in the last 6 months, they've cost me a lot of money. But
yeah?
Yeah, but that's
okay. How much is a lot?
More than all of you make.
That's no way to talk.
You're really making your case there, brother. I feel sorry for you now. Remember that, Sherman?
Yeah.
Amazon and Hachette have resolved their dispute now. Who won?
My book,
Money Bags,
on Amazon is still listed as usually ships within 2 to 4 weeks.
Oh.
There's a number of Hachette authors and books whose books are still embargoed. Or as Ursula Le Guin said the other night, corporate fatwa, which I think is exactly what's going on. I don't know why, if this dispute has been settled, my book with Hachette is still not available. And other books are listed as out of inventory, you know, and these are massive bestseller books by massive bestselling authors, you know, no inventory. So it's a fight between giant corporations. In any fight between, it's like Thor and Loki duking it out. Mm-hmm. And when Thor and Loki duke it out, who dies? All the citizens of Metropolis. And every author is a citizen of Metropolis, regardless of what level you're talking about, whether it's me and my career or a first timer. We're all suffering. And the real problem is that this entire debate revolves around the basic idea of books being treated as commodities, books being treated as lawnmowers and vacuum cleaners and toilet paper, when in fact books are the repository of the country and the culture's imagination and its politics and its religion and its...
So you want the government to take over book sales
instead of European countries. France, for instance, actually views books and bookstores as a national treasure and as a public institutions to be protected as such. And I think that's the kind of legislation we're going to have to talk about to protect books and publishing from rapacious capitalists.
So just final word on Amazon Hachette, and then we'll move on to other things. Do we know? So Amazon is still costing you more money than we make, but how about the reader? Who won or lost in how the dispute got resolved?
The narrower the market gets in terms of who's selling books, the narrower the quality of the books, the narrower the diversity of the books will get worse as fewer and fewer people are selling them.
So this agreement that got resolved, do you know whether that makes things worse?
I don't know yet.
They're still being secretive.
I think it's a stopgap. It's okay. A temporary measure until the renegotiations have to happen again.
Okay. Others?
Well, I was just going to say they'd deliver some of the other books that don't have this Hachette situation going on by drone if they could. They'd be at your house, you know, tonight at midnight if you ordered some of the other books.
I had the impression Amazon's trying to tie up a lot of loose ends before the end of the year, like get publicity-wise, get some stuff off the table. So the Hachette deal. Mm. They also had an agreement with the workers were suing them over working conditions at the plant. So I think they're just trying to get a clean slate. They're still not making any money, and Wall Street's getting nervous.
It's holiday clear conscience shopping season.
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of empty big buildings in South Lake Union.
Well, actually, we're going to talk a little more about the congestion in South Lake Union in a moment. But speaking of how much money Amazon has cost Sherman Alexie,
more than all of you make.
The city of Seattle happens to be exploring a possible tax on high wage earners, people who make
more than all of you make,
people like that. So again. A tax on high-wage earners in the city of Seattle. Knut, cities in Washington State are not allowed to have income taxes, so how would this work?
That's right, which is why the city's exploring an excise tax on wealth.
Wait, an excise tax? That's like on gasoline and stuff. Well, how could that be on
high
earners?
Apparently there's some way you can apply that to income.
This isn't going to fly.
Here's
Give me
the
a
interesting
break.
Thing. So as part of the budgeting process, the Seattle City Council unanimously approved asking the question of their city attorneys, what are the taxing options the city has, such as an excise tax on millionaires or whatever? Can you find a loophole, a gray area, anything to give us more options? The fact is Seattle wants to tax people for all kinds of projects. We all voted on a bunch of new taxes this last year for pre-K and other things. There are a bunch of other things coming down the pike, Sound Transit 3 and other things. The problem is the taxes we can raise are either, in the case of the property tax, they're lidded, the amount you can raise it per year, or they're very regressive. They're sales tax. They're things like car tabs and that kind of thing.
So Washington State is, what, the most regressive taxing
most
state in the country?
Regressive tax system. The poorest people in Washington State pay six times more of their income in taxes than the wealthiest. So so we're passing all these things to make a better city, but the people who but at the price of increasing the tax burden on the people least able to pay. That, I think, is going to catch up with us at some point, which is why the city council is desperate for other options.
But what options, Joni, what options could the city possibly have?
Well, here's what's going to happen. So all of these taxes, you look at this year, it's been an absolute bonanza for new city spending. And Skip, you're a historian. You know this boom and bust. You know this. The citizen, I think there's going to be a huge backlash to this when the bill actually comes due. So if I say to you, do you want pre-K? You say, yeah, sure, that sounds great. Do you want more parks? You say, oh, yeah, awesome, let's do it. But when the bill comes due, and this has happened before, this goes back in time a little bit, there was this cap election many years ago, but it was the citizens rising up and saying too much too fast. And if you look in all these neighborhoods, I'll name Ballard, the rapid upzoning. Folks will come back at this, even though many folks voted for these things, usually like in a close vote. I'm thinking of the Park District, which was, you know, a primary vote, which isn't big turnout. So some people, a very select group, went out and voted for that park thing. And I think there will be some payback for it.
But back to the rich people tax, I haven't heard any options that the city actually has. I suppose the city could try to convince Olympia, Republican-dominated legislature Olympia, to change the law? Yeah,
not
right. Not happening, right?
Yeah, no, but they could have a more coordinated effort with other cities to get permission to have more flexibility on taxes, which is one thing they're going to do. You would think Republicans would like more local control over taxes, but they don't want to approve anything that would be interpreted as giving someone else a permission to have a tax increase.
Sherman, how do you feel about the so-called Sherman-Alexie tax, as we're calling it, as I just named it?
I make enough money to know that rich people who complain about taxes are lying, number one.
Why lying?
Because the incredible number of tax avoidance strategies, tax loopholes, laws that you can use to hide your money, not pay taxes, defer your taxes, lower your taxes. We make enough money to where our bank showed up and asked us if they could lower our mortgage rate. I mean, that's what happens.
Wow, that's what it's like, huh?
And that's the kind of stuff that happens to people who have money. And so whenever I see a rich person complaining about the taxes they paid, they're lying. They are out and out lying. So anybody in this state and in this city who's rich, who's complaining about the amount of taxes they pay, are lying, period. They're lying.
So I'm going to put you down as a supporter of the millionaire tax.
Of course. I love to pay taxes. It's patriotic. It's the most patriotic act in the country is to pay taxes because it's supporting all the programs that I support and some of the ones I don't, but it is helping people all around me, and it's making my country more livable. All around the world, the countries that where you can lead a decent life, where you can have a decent democracy, a decent standard of living, all of those countries are high tax countries. All of those countries are big government countries. So big government and high taxes are necessary for a decent human life.
I'm afraid to ask him about the typical Republican response, which is if you want to pay more taxes, go ahead, Sherman Alexie.
And I'm going to try to make you pay them, too.
There you go. Okay, so now we're talking about gentrification tax bills in this city. Sherman, you work at South Lake Union, right?
My office, yeah, I rent a place.
Right close to your...
In the maw of the dragon.
Your Amazon nemesis in the maw. You actually are at Maw Street and Dragon Avenue.
Yes.
Okay, so have you heard about the city of Seattle telling Amazon that it has to stop hiring private traffic flaggers to police the gridlock in South Lake Union around its parking garage?
Yes. If I'm down there, I don't leave my office anywhere between 3 and 7 because the gridlock is so bad.
Right.
And it used to be policemen. I would see that it was policemen
yeah.
who knew what they were doing. And now it looks like it was work-study students. it looked like some refugee from Capitol Hill, some bearded hipster dude trying to direct traffic, and he doesn't even own a car. I don't think you get to direct traffic if you ride a bicycle to your job.
So do you, then you're just driving around, do you feel like when they're waving traffic around, is that helping you because it's easing your gridlock, or is it hurting you because they're waving out Amazon workers onto the street and stopping you from going on your way?
No, the big thing is here is the reason why you end up having to use these private contractors is because there's no taxes being paid to support real cops with real training doing this in a real serious way.
So if we had the Sherman-Alexie tax...
It's Uber. It's Uber traffic direction is what it is. It's these untrained, unregulated, unlicensed people with lives
in their
hands.
Easy on the poor Uber folks over
there.
Yeah, poor Uber folks. We've all felt sorry for them this week.
But, you know, that neighborhood.
Liberal hipster traffic signal people at the mercy of libertarian billionaires.
But that neighborhood is choking on this rapid upzoning that's going on and that is sort of making its way for future protest. And if you drive down there, like you said, between 3 to 7, oh my gosh, does not look good. It doesn't matter if they're, you know, if they're circus trainers directing the traffic, that you are not moving.
But we have always had traffic jam spots. And as you said, we have off-duty police and parking enforcement folks. It happens at Pacific Place, right? It happens around the city. Well, I don't understand what is different about Amazon employing private traffic flaggers.
Well, private traffic flaggers are not legal.
But if they're off
construction
duty.
Zones.
But what about
they
the
are,
off-duty
no, the
police?
They have to be police officers.
Why?
So trained. Trained. They
trained.
Know how traffic
what,
works.
Okay, so if it would solve the problem if the private flaggers were very, very trained? Would that solve the
a little
problem?
More training. A little
is
more.
That it? So it's not about it's, private versus off-duty police.
Well,
it's just
the
about
law
training.
Is, the law is about...
Right. Okay.
The law says that you can only use private flaggers in construction zones.
Yes.
So you can't use them just to empty a commuter parking garage.
Yeah.
And you can argue about whether or not that is good policy in general. I think the sense is the police, one, are trained. They know what they're doing. Two, I think there's a general sense that they're more accountable, that they have to be fair because their job ostensibly is to be fair to the public. They're not always. I mean, you know, I think anybody who has driven downtown at rush hour, you know, can get infuriated watching somebody let six, seven, eight cars out of a building when the ferry line is trying to get up the hill, you know.
Unless the flaggers dancing. I do like the dancers.
Yeah, if they dance.
So, but here, what I want to know is, why does someone coming out of a private parking garage have any right to be waved onto the street? I mean, I sympathize. It's a long wait, but why is that? Why is the government stopping a driver on a right-of-way to allow somebody who doesn't have the right-of-way to go ahead?
This seems like poor planning all the way around. When they built the garages, did they not think, oh, one day at 5 o'clock, a couple of them may want to come out on the street?
Yeah, but maybe isn't that their problem? And I've been in a parking garage. It's awful. You know, imagine you have a kid in the car who has to go to the bathroom. It's terrible. But you don't have a right to be waved in ahead of it.
After seeing a show at Ben Arroyo, have you ever been in any of the parking garages down there?
Yes. You wave, you plead, you beg, you hope.
But the fact is,
wave, plead, beg, hope, in that order.
They didn't consider it because they didn't consider their effect on the neighborhood, because they don't consider their effect on anything.
This is why corporations have suburban campuses.
I mean, have you seen?
This is why Amazon is beefing up in the city. This is going to happen even more and more.
Well, have you seen the Dropbox video with the soccer field in the Mission District in San Francisco, where this Dropbox team of came to play soccer at this field that has been historically open? And winner takes next game for generations. And these Dropbox guys, all of a sudden there's an app where you can reserve the field, and they show up telling all these kids, all these brown kids, all these white tech guys telling these brown kids that, oh, no, the rules have changed immediately and we're more important now.
But if it was just brown tech guys, would it be okay?
No, okay. It'd be even worse. So this is always the case of these tech companies with their libertarian narcissism and selfishness, deciding that their needs are far more important than the needs that were already established in the community.
Okay, we have to move on. But one thing that happens when we have a congested city is that everybody backs up, not just private cars, but Metro buses back up, and they get off schedule, and then the drivers have to pee. And that's where we will go next on The Week in Review. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review with Sherman Alexie, Knute Berger, and Joni Balter. So, as I was saying, you might not always love your job, but they do have bathrooms at your job, right? Metro buses do not have bathrooms on board, of course, and bus drivers say they don't have time to get off and use the facilities. Driver Brian Sherlock says he and his colleagues suffer physically and mentally.
Drivers are actually resorting to things like Depends. Seriously. Absolutely literally. And the number of unsanitary seats as a result in all this.
Unsanitary seats, you ask? Yes, the drivers' union says vehicle maintenance crews replace 60 urine-soaked drivers' seats every year. Drivers are entitled to bathroom breaks, but they say there's not enough time to take a break and stay on schedule. Metro says it's been responding to a 2009 audit that told it to we all want auditors, right, for Metro that said, tighten up your schedules. They did say, Metro says, Seattle voting yes on Prop 1 should help.
That's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that there should be bathroom breaks in Seattle where they voted yes,
but
and
not,
maybe not so much in the suburbs. No, I'm kidding. The whole thing here is this story, I know it's important.
You want to get there on? Yeah. Have the suburban drivers take every break they are entitled to, and if you don't like it, vote yes next time.
There you go.
Announcement on the mic.
Right on the mic. So it was a little bit TMI, this story, but I guess we need to know.
What's a real... It's a very serious and real labor issue.
It is.
And those of us who've been stuck in traffic, having to go to the bathroom and the pain and the potential embarrassment. You know, I have certain health issues, and I've actually, in traffic, pooped my pants.
Wow.
So
will you please, Bond Huberman is here tweeting. I'll leave that to your discretion,
yes,
Bond.
So
it's up to you.
So So, you know, we can be talking about drivers who might have health conditions. We might be talking about drivers who have less ability.
Pregnant drivers who have bladder pressure. It is a real thing.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, this is not, I mean, it's funny and it's funny and cute, but it's also serious.
Yeah.
And it's about a basic human right.
That's why I brought it up.
Yeah. Well, the bus I take, I live at the end of the line. And so the bathroom break is always right before I get to the last stop.
Why? Why not after the last?
Because it goes through a little commercial district where there are bathrooms, as opposed to stopping in a residential area where the layover is, where there is no bathroom.
Oh.
And
shouldn't there be bathrooms where the layover is?
You know, when you've been lurching around on a bus during a rush hour, you really don't like being stopped a half mile from home while the guy takes a break and does that. On the other hand, often I'll just get off the bus and walk, so it's good for my health to get the extra exercise.
Does the driver tell you what he or she is doing? Because I've seen a bus stop and the driver gets off, and I'm thinking, what's happening?
He's mad at us. Yeah.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. But it's always in sort of the same one or two locations that they stop.
Mm.
So everybody on the bus knows what's going on. And I don't think anybody really begrudges them doing that. In fact, I'm happy.
They do.
What's that?
I think they do. I think it's this general idea of treating anybody in the service industry as less than human, of dehumanizing anybody in the service industry. And I think this is part of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right about that. I mean, otherwise they wouldn't need those signs that say, you know, it's a felony to touch the bus driver. You know, I mean, obviously there are a lot of people who are really rude.
Right. I didn't realize until I read the stories about this, I think it was the Seattle Times, that many Starbucks are established as official Metro rest stops.
And Panera Bread places.
Yeah. Yeah. But then the Starbucks closes at, you know, 8 or 9, and they could go into a bar, but then that looks bad to have a Metro driver walk into a bar.
Well, Starbucks always wanted to be the third place. We just didn't know exactly what they meant by
that. Third and Union place for Metro drivers.
Howard Schultz, you know, I hate him for losing the Sonics, but he always comes up with these amazing progressive ideas. I'm conflicted about that, man.
Some people think he wants to run for president. He keeps rolling out all
he
these.
He seems to think he wants to run for president.
And then he's going to sell the White House to Clay Bennett in Oklahoma City.
The White House to Oklahoma City. It could happen. You heard, if it does happen, I just want to say you heard, right? You did hear it here first. And one other note on traffic since we're on this. Remember the Skagit River Bridge collapsed last year? Interstate 5 fell into the Skagit River. The State Patrol has ticketed the driver whose oversized load knocked down the bridge. The load was 2 inches over legal height. The ticket amount, $550.
That's a bargain right there.
$500 for a freeway bridge.
Right. There you go. And the person who was driving the lead car, the pilot car, I believe it's called, no fine.
Nothing.
Talking on the phone, you know.
Was talking on the phone. My understanding is that she was talking to her husband, but she says it was work-related, if I got that right. Anyway, no citation for the pilot car.
She wanted to know where the future bathroom was.
Right.
I know.
So now you know.
In the Arboretum, at least once a month, there's a truck stuck that rock bridge.
Oh, yeah. The sewer trestle.
I don't know about this. Yes. Tell me about this.
Well, there's a small little bridge over the boulevard in the Arboretum. And it actually carries a sewer line, but it's an Olmsted thing. It's actually a city landmark. It's a beautiful little footbridge. And it's just a little lower than most things. And so people go out and rent a rider truck and then thunk. And gets stuck in there, rips the top of the truck off. And they have these flashing signs that warn you if your load is too high. And but if you're not paying attention.
If you're on the phone.
Yeah.
Or your pilot car is on the phone. I hate when my pilot car is on the phone on Lake
your
Washington.
Pilot card, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, this driver doesn't even want the $500 ticket, says that he's challenged. The driver has challenged the ticket. And the bridge is back up over Skagit River.
That's the most important thing.
Yeah. Sorry, everybody in Skagit County. This is KOW's Week in Review with Joni Balter and Knute Berger and Sherman Alexi. And we're going to talk about not talking in just a moment. And then performance art talking. Stay tuned. We're all about that bass on KOW. I'm losing control of my guests, so we need to wrap it up here pretty soon. Everyone's just laughing about something different at this point. Let's bring in Luke Burbank and Tame the Lions. Luke Burbank from TBTL and from LiveWire. Hey, Luke.
Hello there, everybody.
You've been listening to the show, right?
Yeah, and, you know, when your producer, Jason Pagano, emailed me this week, he said, "We got Sherman," and I thought he was talking about Richard Sherman.
Oh, better.
I'm still pretty excited that it's Sherman Alexie.
Well, I enjoy all the headlines, right. Like Sherman Helps Youth Group was a headline the other day, and it wasn't me, but I felt good about myself anyway.
I'll take Sherman Alexie if that's all I can get here. This is the Week in Review reviewed, okay,
right.
Starting with the elephant story. And I have to say, I am actually the voice of some of the TV commercials for the Woodland Park Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not going to be offering my services next year to do that. Not because the zoo isn't staffed by good people, because I really think it is. But I think what it felt like to me listening to the panel talk is that our feelings on the zoo have really evolved over time. And I just don't think taking these charismatic megafauna and sticking them in kind of a relatively small area is a great idea. I do think, by the way, we can trace the roots of the health problems for the elephants back to an 8-year-old Canute Berger getting a ride.
That's true. There's
some not have been
that.
Good for those elephants. On the Obama immigration thing, I feel like this is for bleeding heart liberals like me. This is actually great. Obama has now turned into Liam Neeson in those movies where they keep kidnapping his families. He doesn't have an approval rating. He doesn't have a mandate. But he will now just apparently go for it and has absolutely no fear of what his public sort of opinion ratings are. I will, on the subject of the Liam Neeson movies, I just want to mention that if someone kidnaps your family like once, that's kind of on the kidnappers. But if it happens like 4 times, that begins to be about you, Liam Neeson.
Look inward.
Also, by the way, 2042 is the date that demographers project that the majority of this country will be non-white people. So to the Republicans, I would just say, keep opposing things that help people who have immigrated to this country. Keep doing that and see how that works out from a political standpoint. Story number three, Hachette versus Amazon. I really can't actually understand who's in the right on this one, but I want to keep coming and playing basketball at Sherman's private gym in South Lake Union. So I'm 100% siding with Alexie on this one. And pointing out the fact that Sherman, I guess it's good news that you don't have as much money now that we know that the high wage tax is just around the corner. And even though you're poor, I hope you'll still let me come to your private gym in South Lake Union. Speaking of South Lake Union, here's what I think this private traffic flaggers thing is. It's like a net neutrality issue. The people that are working at these buildings, they're directing the traffic. They hold a huge amount of power in their hands. And if you think about it, who are they going to let go when it's kind of 50-50? The person they see every single day coming out of that Amazon building, their friends, basically, their cronies, or us, the regular non-Amazonians who are just trying to get around. I think there's an inherent fairness issue there. And on the subject of bus diapers and the bus drivers wearing Depends, and then Sherman's story about how he has had an accident himself while sitting in his car. This explains so much about why nobody wants to guard Sherman when we're playing basketball in his private basketball dome in South Lake Union. And that is the Week in Review review, everybody.
Awesome. Luke, we got just a couple minutes left, and since we're talking sports, I want to bounce this off of you. The Seahawks star running back Marshawn Lynch was fined $100,000 this week by the NFL for refusing to talk to reporters after the games. And here's the beautiful part. After the fine was announced, Lynch went before reporters like he was supposed to answer questions such as, "Marshawn, was that your back or your knee that was tightening up at halftime?"
"My cleats is pretty, they pretty cool, man. I really like my cleats. I like to be able to play in these nice cleats.
I really like my cleats." So he's technically talking to reporters, but he's giving them non-answers. And then he goes further and turns the table on the questioners.
I'm interested in y'all take on it. What's y'all take on it?
I want to hear what you know.
I know you want to hear what I want to say, but I want to hear what you want to say.
Oh, no, that's kind of a fun
question. Sounded reasonable.
I'm getting
it. Sounded reasonable? What do you feel about it? About me being on the sideline, not going back in the
reporters are just staring at him because reporters are not programmed to answer questions. Marshawn Lynch is my new hero. Luke, do you disagree?
I just love that he's bringing the enthusiasm and believability to these interviews as he does to the Beacon Plumbing commercials. Nobody knows about a hair clog or a root intrusion like Marshawn Lynch.
We have a minute left. I feel like if he doesn't have anything to add, the questions are stupid, the answers are stupid. And thank you, Marshawn Lynch. But anyone disagree?
These are all part of his farewell address.
Yeah, he's leaving Seattle, awesome. Isn't he?
That's right.
The thing is, the less he talks, the better he plays. Pete Carroll should pay his fine.
What if he went to reporters and said, okay, let's talk about concussions and drug use. You want to talk? I'll talk.
Well, somebody has finally placed a value on talking or not talking to the press. It's got a number now, folks.
Luke Burbank is a few hours away from bringing you Live Wire, 8 o'clock tonight on KUOW. He hosts the great podcast TBTL. Luke, thanks a lot.
Thanks. We have Marshawn Lynch tonight.
You do not, do you?
No, of course not. Have you heard him?
Sorry. Andrea Seabrook, Decode DC podcast. Sherman Alexi, Knute Berger from CrossCut.com, Joni Balter from Civic Cocktail and Bloomberg View. This show is produced by Jason Pagano. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Back next week.